Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Happy Tuesday, May the 8th. I appreciate you tuning in this morning. I hope we're going to help get your day started together. Be good. We've been talking about teachers today because teachers are a big deal. And Rebecca, you were homeschooled, weren't you?
I was indeed.
Yeah, so you must have a good teacher story.
I do.
You better have one.
She's probably especially
if your mom is listening.
She might be listening right now. Hi, Mom. My mom was a teacher before I was born as well.
Okay.
So she was trained in the classroom. She loved kids, loved helping kids. And her background had to do with kids with special needs as well. So a lady with a lot of patience, and boy, does she need it with all four of us kids in the house. So It was one of those things where they made that decision. And it wasn't a very common decision back then. You hear a lot more about homeschooling than you did, you know, all those decades ago when I was a little one. But they were making that choice and sort of developing the curriculum that fit each single one of us best. And I think that's one of the reasons I have so much respect for teachers, that if you have a collection, whether it's just one child's, you're finding what they respond to, what the call of their heart is, what their strengths are, the calling that God has placed on their life, and how they best glorify Him. You see that in each individual child. It can be so different, even in the same family, what each kid's strengths and weaknesses are, and how to give them the confidence to really build them into, you know, real, fully rounded, well-developed human beings. But there's so much that goes into that, and part of it is just being there and caring, the mentorship of that, and then stimulating your minds in your unique skills as well. That takes so much patience, so much investment. So, I mean, I love you, Mom. Thanks for instilling in me how much I love to read. And it's probably her fault that I know so many words, because she always told me to go to the dictionary when I didn't know something. It's a great thing. I feel like I had a great foundation. And
that's
so
awesome.
I just want to celebrate the teachers that are out there, especially those who are home educating as well, or who are taking on that mentorship role in maybe a different or non-traditional, quote unquote, way. You matter way more than you know.
I remember I had an English literature teacher in my, I think it was my senior year or junior year, said to me, or day one, he said, A is for Arnold, and that's what you'll be getting this quarter. And I thought, Cool.
Glad that's settled.
Yeah. But I was then eager to try to live up to his expectations.
Yeah.
And I did, in fact, get an A. And I worked harder, I think, in his class than any other, because I couldn't not do what he thought I was going to do.
Right, because he believed in you. And he had set that expectation out there that I know you can achieve this.
Yeah, he probably
sometimes
said that. He probably said that to the Anderson kid behind me, though, too.
That could be.
Anyway. You know, I find it fascinating that people who are global climate change alarmist, that they're probably going to be the least eco-friendly. I was reading an article that if you're highly concerned about supporting government action on climate, there's a good chance you are least likely to behave in eco-friendly ways. Isn't that interesting? And the people that were like, they didn't really, one way or the other, thinks too much about climate change, they were the ones that had such environmentally friendly behaviors in terms of recycling and using public transportation and buying green products and using reusable shopping bags. I found that interesting, that the ones that are crying out the loudest are not the most eco-friendly. And I always love having Cal Beisner on the program, and he's on our studio line right now waiting to come on. So let's bring him on. It's 8 minutes after the hour. I'll be right back.
You know how to tell them. Wipe off that full of doubt. Look, slap on a happy grin. And spread sunshine all over.
It's 10 minutes after the hour. Dr. Cal Beisner is founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. That is a network of over 60 Christian theologians and scientists and economists and other scholars, and they're educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace. And he's on our program this morning. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Bill. Great to be back with you.
I learn so much every time you're on the program. So I said to Rebecca, we got to get Cal back on because I went on your website and I signed up to get all of your updates and everything. And then I saw I had an opportunity to donate to your cause, which I did. And then in response to that, I got the Climate Hustle, the DVD, which is absolutely so interesting, entertaining. I just enjoyed it so much.
Well, I'm really glad you did. It's an entertaining film. It's funny and educational at the same time. That's always a nice combination.
And I found it interesting, too, when I saw that article a couple of days ago, and I think that triggered me wanting to get you back on the program, that seems to be the climate alarmists are the least likely to be eco-friendly. I found that interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I read the same article, Bill, that you're talking about, and at one point they ask why it is that belief in climate change predicted support for government policies to combat climate change, but didn't generally translate to the individual level, you know, self-reported pro-environmental behavior.
Right.
And, you know, they asked why and said, well, even the researchers were stumped, although it's possible that skeptics may place more emphasis on personal responsibility than government action. Now, I'll grant, I think that's a possible explanation of it, but I think there's another one that is more likely. You know, if you are totally convinced that the number one environmental problem facing the world is climate change, and that it is driven by all the different things that we do using fossil fuel energy, and you understand that fossil fuel energy provides about 85% of all the energy used in the world, and that yours amounts to, you know, just a minuscule proportion of that. I mean, certainly not worth bothering with. You might as well spit in the ocean and expect to raise sea level as think that a change in your energy use can make any significant difference in the world. If you're so focused on that one issue, then frankly, you don't have much attention left. You don't have much motivation left to focus on others.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's the others that are far more relevant to people's health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people can thrive in any climate from the Arctic Circle to the Sahara Desert, but if they're poor, they can't thrive anywhere. And yet, poverty and environmental degradation constantly go together. And that's because a clean, healthful, beautiful environment, like any other costly good, is more affordable to those who are reasonably wealthy than to those who are having a difficult time putting another meal on the table.
You know, Cal, I saw on the Climate Hustle DVD, there was a scientist that was saying that actually our Earth is a little CO2 starved.
Yes.
I found that kind of shocking.
Yeah, that's true.
Is that true? Yeah. Say more on that, if you
know. Well, folks think that we're just driving CO2 up to dangerous levels. Well, frankly, it depends on what you're talking about in terms of danger. CO2 is not dangerous in terms of our breathing it until you get above about 10,000 parts per million, and you stay at that for many hours in a row, you know, days in a row, and yet the composition of CO2 in the atmosphere is only around 400 parts per million. In other words, we could go to more than 20 times that and still not put anybody at risk. What people think the danger comes from is its warming effect. But increasing empirical studies are telling us that its warming effect, though it's real, is so small that it's probably undetectable, certainly doesn't have any impact on any ecosystem or on human well-being. And the reality is that instead, More CO2 in the atmosphere is a really good thing because it is essential to plant growth.
Mm-hmm.
Plants use it in photosynthesis to turn energy from sunlight along with nitrogen and in the atmosphere and various nutrients in the soil and water into plant material, fiber and fruit. And frankly, 280 parts per million, which is what the atmosphere had around the Industrial Revolution, is so low that plants don't do their growth very well. As it rises, they get better and better. In fact, for every doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, you get an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. And so food availability rises for everything that eats plants or eats something that does eat plants. And
mm-hmm.
That means everything.
Mm-hmm. Cal, there was a Journal of Environmental Psychology, and it divided subjects into three categories. I thought this was very helpful. They were the skeptical, the cautiously worried, and the highly concerned. So let me take a quick break. And if you see yourself in one of those categories and you would like to ask Dr. Cal Beisner a question, certainly willing to take a couple questions. 877-933-2484 is the studio line, 877-933-2484. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Dr. Cal Beisner is my guest. We'll be right back. Minutes after the hour, Dr. Cal Beisner is my guest from the Cornwall Alliance. And Cal, I so appreciate your thinking. And I was watching this video that I got, and it was pretty much, people like newscasters and talking about climate change and how New York and Boston, they'll be underwater, as will London, and pretty soon the oceans will be boiling. And I go, really? Really?
Yeah, well, your response to that is quite appropriate. You were mentioning that this study in the Journal of Environmental Psychology pointed out that of the three categories that they identified among people about their beliefs about climate change or global warming, highly concerned, cautiously worried, and skeptical, the people who were most likely to report a lot of individual actions that were, helpful to the environment, good environmental stewardship, who were the skeptical, and the least likely were the highly concerned folks. They just simply didn't tend to do anything significant about protecting the environment. Well, I think that that's rather expectable, and here's part of why. Robert K. Merton, who was a philosopher of science back in the early 20th century, wrote in an article in the journal Philosophy of Science in 1938, "Most institutions demand unqualified faith, but the institution of science makes skepticism a virtue." And that wasn't just simply Merton's opinion as one individual. The Royal Society, which is the world's oldest national scientific institution, founded in November of 1660, chartered by King Charles II in England, the Royal Society has a motto, and that motto is nullius in verba, the Latin for on the word of no one or take nobody's word for it. That's the real scientific attitude. And so you can expect that people who really think scientifically, who say, I don't take anybody's word for it, except God's, by the way, is that those people are the ones who are going to be the most scientific in their thinking. And that also means then that instead of just being subservient to those who claim, oh, there's this overwhelming consensus of scientists in favor of dangerous man-made warming, they're going to think, no, I want to look at the actual physical evidence. And when they do that, they discover that CO2's warming effect is very, very slight, whereas its benefit to plant growth and therefore the availability of food for everybody and everything is tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the weather system the most complicated system in the world? And CO2 is just one factor of many, many, many that would affect climate change?
Yeah, with the possible exception of the human brain and DNA, the climate system is indeed the most complicated natural system we've ever ever studied. And in fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which the true believers in dangerous warming consider that to be like the highest authority on this issue, said back in 2001 in its third assessment report that because the climate system is a coupled, nonlinear, fluid dynamic, chaotic system, it is, in fact, in principle, impossible to predict future temperature states of the whole climate system. Well, you know, that is absolutely true. It is impossible to predict where a chaotic, fluid dynamic, coupled, nonlinear system is going to be, you know, 5 years from now, or 100 years from now, or 20 days from now. You can't do it. And it's fascinating to me that despite that, they continue every 5 to 7 years or so putting out new big assessment reports in which they try to do exactly what they say is impossible to do.
Yeah. Well, as an aside, Cal, speak for yourself, because my brain is not that complicated, just so you know.
Oh, Bill, I think you underrate yourself.
Okay, well, trust me, I don't. Let's talk about some of the reasons that alarmists might be just wrong on climate change. I know there's 4 points. Maybe you can cover those briefly.
Well, I'd say the first one, and you may be making reference to a particular article by Vijay Jayaraj, research consultant to the Cornwall Alliance for Developing Countries. Vijay works out these 4 basic reasons in an article that he just recently had published. And they would be this. The first is that skeptics are not deniers. The alarmists are always saying, look, if you're skeptical about this, you must be a denier. You're a denier of climate change, you're a denier of science, and so on. That's not so. I mean, we have to understand that right from the get-go. And then as for the 4 reasons why, the climate change alarmists are likely wrong. First, one, global warming is indeed real, but scientists disagree about its magnitude and causes and how we should respond to it. The alarmists say not only is global warming real, but there is practical unanimity that it's going to be huge, it's going to be dangerous, it's almost entirely driven by CO2, and we need to cut CO2 emissions to deal with it. No, they're wrong to put all of those together that way. Second, human emissions of carbon dioxide are one of the many causes of global warming, but they're not the primary driver. The climate alarmists pin everything on CO2. Geological history tells us that the world is warmed and cooled over and over and over again without any contribution from CO2, and in fact, that CO2 tends to follow changes in temperature rather than precede them, which means that the alarmists get the cart before the horse. Third, Jayaraj points out that carbon dioxide emission from human activity has actually failed to cause substantial increase in global temperatures. There has, for example, been no statistically significant increase in global temperature for at least the past 18 years, and depending on what data set you're looking at, it could be as much as 26 or even 30 years. And then finally, the global warming alarmists have a tendency to point to various record highs and say, see, that proves that CO2 is driving rapid, dangerous global warming. Well, the fact is, it's statistically inevitable that on any given day, you're going to have record highs somewhere in the world. And those are weather. Weather is short-term and local. They're not climate. Mm-hmm. Climate is long-term and regional or global.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Cal, I just love having you on the show. I learned so much, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on. And CornwallAlliance.org is the website to go read more about Cal and his colleagues and what they write about all of this. So Anything else, Cal, as a parting thought?
Well, Bill, you mentioned that you had donated to Cornwall Alliance.
I did.
And had received a copy of that film, Climate Hustle. There is a whole book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change by Mark Morano, who's the main character in the movie that mm-hmm. you saw.
Yeah.
And we are offering that this month
awesome.
Our way of saying thanks to anybody who makes a donation of any size.
Well,
you can find out about that by going to cornwallalliance.org, signing up for our e-newsletter, and we'll tell them how.
Yeah, I'll probably go on and make another donation because I want that book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Cal. Have a great week, and thanks for coming on the show.
God bless you, Bill. Thank you.
God bless you. It's 27 minutes after the hour. Let's take a little break, and we'll go hear Breakpoint. It's 32 minutes after the hour. My Minnesota Twins beat Dick Whitworth's Cardinals last night, 6-0. So hopefully we'll be back on good terms today. Let's take a little break for news, and when we come back, Dr. Bruce Ashford's going to be with us talking about his new book, Letters to an American Christian. Be very interested to hearing more about that in about 6 minutes.
I've always thought that parents need to spend less time trying to control their teens and more time helping them develop responsibility and maturity. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. I've watched dads spend years trying to gain control of their teens and end up losing it anyway. In the process, they also lose their relationship with their kids. And I've seen moms so fearful that their kids might do something wrong that they develop an unhealthy attachment, and they're unwilling to detach. In order for children to become healthy adults, they'll have to become independent from mom and dad. And parents have the power to build an environment where that's possible. So mom, dad, exercise your skill of letting go.
Having trouble parenting your teen in today's rapidly changing culture? Get instant access to Mark's new free parenting course online at freeparentingcourse.com.
Minutes until the top of the hour. You know, it was interesting talking to Dr. Cal Bisner about scientific consensus. It's always interesting. I mean, 4 out of 5 dentists recommend sugarless gum. Of course, dentist number 5 drives a Ferrari. How do they find a dentist who disagrees with that? You can't get 5 dentists to agree about the harmful effects of sugar on your teeth? Really? Anyway, I have on our studio line Dr. Bruce Ashford, who's a regular guest and friend of the show, and he is a provo at Southeastern Baptist Seminary. Did I say that right, Rebecca?
Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary.
All right, I left out a word here and there. And he's got a book coming out June 1st, which I cannot wait to pre-order, called Letters to an American Christian. He's on our studio line right now. Hello, Bruce.
Bill, thanks for having me on the show, man.
Yeah.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, and thanks for letting us tease the book, because I think this is going to be a great book. I'm excited about it, and I want to hear more about it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, Letters to an American Christian, it releases June the 1st, but it's available for pre-order now. It was more fun than a barrel of monkeys. Right. I mean,
we know how fun a barrel of monkeys is.
Yeah, barrel of drunk monkeys. And, you know, so this is the first time I've written a book that is you know, it's a collection of letters, 26 letters to a hypothetical college student named Christian,
okay,
who has ironically just become a Christian.
Uh-huh.
And he's at a leftist university. Most of them are leftist.
Uh-huh.
In fact, today I saw on Fox News Insider, a study just came out that said that 40% of liberal arts colleges have not a single Republican on staff.
40%.
Interesting. Yep, interesting fact. 39%,
so,
actually,
yeah.
To be accurate.
And what about a conservative? Unlikely.
Yeah, very unlikely.
Yeah.
So basically, I'm writing to this young man. He's double majoring in politics and journalism. And what I'm coaching him, basically, is that he doesn't have to take the leftist path that all of his professors are encouraging him and trying to force him into. But he also doesn't have to take the kind of angry and ugly conservative path that we've seen a little bit, you know, grow up in on the right. And so it's a fun book, make lots of cultural references, able to joke around a little bit, but also deliver substantive content, not just for college students, but for American Christians who want to cut their own wake.
Mm.
You know, for American Christians who don't want to be told that they have to be in monochrome uniformity
yeah.
with any agenda on the left or the right.
Oh, Bruce, this is the perfect book at the perfect time.
Yeah, you know, the idea for this book, I wrote a book on politics in 2015, right before the election cycle, and little did I know just how big the 2016 election cycle would be. In the past 2 years, I've gotten, you know, literally thousands of emails and communications, probably tens of thousands,
mm-hmm.
in response to Fox News articles that I've written or response to books that basically just say, hey, would you write something different in light of our new political situation? And so that's what this is. It's a book, Letters to a Christian American. It's a book that I hope people will read at the beach and in their easy chair.
Yeah.
A fun book.
Yeah, good. I like it. That's the only time I would read a book would be at the beach or in an easy chair. Can you give us a little sneak preview of what a letter might look like and what it might sound like?
Yeah. So, you know, the very first chapter, I think, is when this kid writes me a letter and says, hey, you know, I understand that you're a professor of Christianity, politics, and public life, that you teach on these things. I just became a Christian, and all of my professors are on the left. My parents are very far in the distant fever swamps of the right, and help coach me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in the very first chapter, what he does is he repeats an argument made by his progressive professor that religion has no business being in the public square. And so I coach the student and show him that basically you cannot separate your politics from your religion. By definition, the Bible teaches that a person's religion is found in whatever that person ascribes ultimacy to, right? Every human being is a worshiper. Every human being is religious, atheist, Muslim, Christian, secular, I mean, you name it. We're all religious because we all absolutize something. We make mm-hmm. something ultimate. It's not the God of Jesus Christ. It's sex or money or power. And so religion, you know, the Bible says that whatever it is that we make ultimate in life, sex or money or power or Jesus or whatever, that becomes a central organizer for our life. And so religion is not private. I mean, it is private, but it's also public. I mean, whatever it is that we've made ultimate is going to radiate outward into the rest of our life, and that includes our politics. So I show this young man how to answer his professor
mm-hmm.
and say that you can't separate your politics from your religion. Your religion will always affect your politics. And the real question is, which is the best religion that will achieve the common good
mm-hmm.
in the public square?
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to show that Christianity is.
So, Bruce, if a professor said that you can't have religion anywhere in public life, what might be a good question to ask back to that professor?
Yeah, well, first thing I'd ask him is, how do you define religion? And inevitably, the professor will say something, probably something condescending, but will also say something like this. He'll say, well, it's the worship of a supernatural deity, and it can't be proven. And therefore, it shouldn't be brought to the public square. And you know, your religion is a matter of your private worship of this supernatural deity. Somebody else's religion is a matter of their private worship. But then there are lots of people who aren't religious. Anyway, you should keep all this stuff private. And what I would come back and say is a couple of things. Number one, no, you can't participate in identity politics and tribalized politics along the lines of economics or race or something else, and then tell people they can't identify by their religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing that I would say is you define religion wrongly. Religion is not the private worship of the supernatural deity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wholehearted, full-life worship of something. It might be a deity, or it might be sex, or money, or power, or success, or the approval of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, that's a little bit of a game changer. You know, and the person you're talking with is probably not going to know exactly how to answer.
Yeah, so this fictitious student named Christian, who just became a Christian, as he's starting to answer these questions, is he angered? Is he provoked? Is he confused? Because I'm trying to figure out what category I'd be in if I was dealing with someone like that.
Well, you know, in the book, what happens is the kid becomes very excited about the fact that all of a sudden he doesn't have to be in swan step uniformity with any political movement of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
He can cut his own wake. And in the book, he becomes the most independent thinker in his political science department, which is composed of 47 Democrats and one Republican. And he becomes a little bit of an irritant in his own family because his family has taken on some sort of extreme or aberrant, you know, forms of conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up writing for a conservative cable news network, which is what I do. I write for Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
And so I coach him through his environment with liberal professors and his environment writing opinion pieces for a conservative outlet. You know, I've got lots of fun chapters in Letters to an American Christian, those of you out there in radio land. I've got one, chapter 12 is entitled, Nobody Throws a Tantrum Like a Politically Correct American, where I deal with political correctness. Chapter 14 is No Need for Mullahs at 1 First Street. 1 First Street is where the Supreme Court is.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just arguing that the Supreme Court justices on the left treat themselves like Muslim mullahs, trying to sort of legislate their own version of morality and force it on the rest of us Americans. I've got, you know, chapter 22 is entitled Restoring the Self. And that's where I show how you can talk with a transgender person and talk about how God can restore them and restore their self, even if they're confused about their gender, even if they've experienced some sort of, you know, pain
mm-hmm.
over their confusion. So just lots of, I treat Black Lives Matter.
Oh, interesting.
I treat political correctness and,
yep.
and you know, safe spaces and immigration, nationalism, faith,
yeah.
all these topics.
Sign me up. I'm ready to pre-order. I'm going to do that
okay.
I'm going to do that during the break because we need to take a short break. And we'll come back more with Dr. Bruce Ashford in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. My guest is Dr. Bruce Ashford, Provost Dean of the Faculty at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary and a regular guest of the show, one of my faves. He's got a new book coming out in June 1, called Letters to an American Christian. And we need to, as Christians, sort of be in the world but not of the world. And we need to take our heavenly and earthly citizenships seriously. And this book will help us get a nice perspective on trying to do both and engage in conversations with others about what it is to be a Christian and to stand firm. And Bruce, I just find that after so many years of being around students, this is probably a perfect natural outcome of a book to write to, A, speak to students, and then, B, to speak to older students like me.
Yeah, so you know, just for those of you out there in radio land, I would invite you, you can pre-order the book right now on Amazon. It'll ship out on June the 1st. And although I wrote the book in the form of letters to a college student, helping him to not buy into the secular progressivism of his profs or the secular aberrant versions of conservatism of his parents, really I wrote the book for all of us, American Christians, like you put it, Bill,
yeah.
who are trying to figure out how can we cut our own wake? How can we engage in politics and public life with truth and grace? And in a way that our politics conforms to our Christianity
mm-hmm.
instead of vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, we're tempted to let our Christianity conform to our politics. Does that make sense?
Total sense. When we can't shrink away from what's going on in the world, but you know, we need to be in the world, but not of the world. But we also have to obviously keep our eyes focused on our heavenly citizenship and bring that perspective into our conversations that we have with others.
Yeah, you know, the big question, you put it really well. How can we be in the world but not of the world? And to add to that, how can we be in the world and not of the world when things have changed so much in the past 10 years? I mean, the ground beneath us, socially, culturally, politically, religiously, has shifted so quickly that we're sort of, it's like we've been knocked off of our feet, and we're trying to stand up and figure out how what's our next move. And in my opinion, the radio talk shows, other than yours, of course, and TV talk shows often aren't helpful. Mostly they're run by seculars
mm-hmm.
for people who've been shaped mostly by a secular agenda. And I think we need to be really careful as Christians to, you know, think carefully through our stance on political issues. And this book is really a manual for that. I've taken 26 really hot topics, the kind of stuff you'll hear addressed on Fox News, Fox Opinion, CNN, you know, the newspaper that you read, radio shows and so forth, and tried to give a very brief and easy to read, fun treatment of all these hot topics.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, what was the hardest chapter to write, or which chapter got rewritten the most number of times?
That's a good question. Probably my concluding chapter, where I tried to draw it all together.
Okay.
It was difficult to write the concluding chapter because there's such a dizzying array, just a dump truck load of issues that we're having to deal with right now. It's disconcerting and disorienting. I think all of us are just trying to figure out, you know, what in the world is going on right now. Our political scene is like I say it all the time, it's like a combination of a war, a carnival, and a Hollywood movie, a bad Hollywood movie even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not picking on any one person. I mean, it's just the entire environment, you know, on the left and even on the right.
You know, but if I'm being encouraged to read this book on the beach, by the time I get to the conclusion, I'm much more obsessed about my own personal sunburn than I am your conclusion.
Yeah, especially if you've read the entire book on the beach.
Yeah.
You know, without your sunscreen.
Yeah. Well, just in the couple minutes we have left, can you jump to one more chapter in the book just to tease us a little more? Because I've already clicked pre-order.
So you already, okay,
you already have me.
Yeah, great. So how about chapter 10 entitled Unborn Lives Matter? So Black Lives Matter is a movement, you know, and I can affirm that Black Lives do matter, but I don't affirm the Black Lives Matter movement as a whole, because it's a political movement and with socialist tendencies. So instead of Black Lives Matter, and I do have a chapter on Black Lives Matter, this one, Unborn Lives Matter, deals with abortion. And what I try to do is equip this, you know, an American Christian to not only give religious arguments against abortion, but also sociological arguments. Sometimes sociology, you know, or legal arguments or philosophical arguments might be a little more persuasive. So, for example, I give four different secular views of the baby. The baby is a part of the mother. The baby's a parasite. The baby's property. That's how the law treats a baby.
Wow.
Property of a mother. I thought we had gotten beyond viewing other human beings as our property, but we haven't. And so I talk about those four different views, and then I pick a view and say that the baby's actually a human person. And I give seven or eight sociological arguments against abortion. If we're going to list them, how much time do we have? 2 minutes?
We've got about 2 minutes.
Okay. So, you know, the baby dies in an agonizing manner, and a baby has less protection in America than an endangered species of bird in a tropical forest. That's
wow.
A fact.
Wow.
Abortion not only harms babies, but women. It tells women that it's okay to use lethal violence to solve their problems. It catalyzes male irresponsibility and sexual predation, destabilizes marriage. It harms our democracy. It undermines our claim to be a law-governed democracy because of abortion, we can never say that everyone is created equal and there will be justice for all.
Mm-hmm.
Because babies are not created equal and there will not be justice for them.
Wow.
Mediating institutions, you know, it undermines... Abortion assumes that there are only two actors of significance in society, and that is the state, the government, and the individual, and in specific, the mother. They're the only two that matter. Father doesn't matter. He has no say. Siblings don't matter. They have no say. And then finally, just society at large, it teaches our people that it's okay to solve your problems by using lethal violence, but just cover up your tracks by using language that doesn't tell the truth about reality. Don't call it a baby, call it the products of conception.
Mm-hmm.
Don't call it murder, call it, you know, abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what we need to do as Christians is we need to be equipped and ready to, in public, to tell what we believe and why in a way that's persuasive. That's what I hope this book, Letters to an American Christian, does. If you can pre-order it today and get a really good deal on it financially on Amazon, Letters to an American Christian.
Yeah. Bruce, we'll talk about this again because I'm going to get my own copy, and then we'll have further discussion about the book maybe in the next two or three weeks. How's that?
Thanks a lot, Bill.
All right.
Much appreciated.
Have a great day. A couple minutes till the top of the hour, and we'll wrap up the show. Thanks for listening. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you in the morning. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.